All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah. And it is cold today, okay? It's really cold. It's cold in here and cold out there. I don't know what the hell is happening here. I'm sitting with a big jacket and a hat on, all right? It's good because the show is going to be hot. There you go. I got to work that one in, all right? The show is going to be hot today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. I'm going to be talking about where we're at right now in the fight against police brutality, including the nationwide protests that occurred on New Year's, and what it's going to take to end this whole epidemic of police murder. And that is very much related to the opening segment of the show. People realize, remember back to, last month, right, when the Senate report on torture was released. And, you'd think for a while there was like a lot of upheaval. There was a lot of back and forth, a lot of outrage expressed, but not quite what you would think that such a damning document might call forth in the society. And I was thinking about that, and I've also been reading a book from Henry Giroux. And Henry's a person that we've had on the show in the past, and I was reading his latest book, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine. And as I was reading, I was thinking about some of the things that Henry says in this book, and also then stumbled onto a piece that he wrote, appeared first in Counterpunch, and then was further developed in Truth Out. And I wanted to talk with Henry about his thinking on all this stuff around torture. Henry Giroux is joining us to talk about this today, The Violence of Organized Forgetting and Torture. He's an author and professor. He currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department, and he's a distinguished visiting professorship at Ryerson University. Henry, welcome to the show. Welcome back, man.
Yeah, hi, Michael.
Hi.
Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too, man. We'll have to do this more often, okay? Well, let's jump into this. Writing in relation to the Senate report, as I was talking about, it comes out, it sort of makes there's a big splash. But you writing in relation to the Senate report on torture when it was released, your argument was that America is addicted to torture and that this addiction has become intensified as part of a broader national psychosis. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, the argument is, I think that a lot of people seem to think that torture, since it's been most recently revealed by the Senate report in a very public kind of way, it's sort of an aberration. It's something that hasn't often happened in the United States, and that after 9/11, of course, a series of events produced extreme measures that now can be at least acknowledged but seen as something, sort of marginal to the definition of American history. And my argument, of course, in that piece was that that's nonsense, that the United States has a long history of torture, not just simply abroad in terms of what it's done in other countries from Vietnam to Guatemala to supporting dictatorships in Chile and Argentina and actually training, in some cases, the people who committed those tortures. But you also have a history of systemic torture domestically in the United States. I point to the Chicago episode in the 1950s and 70s, where John Borg, I think was his name, a police commander who actually tortured over 100 African-American males to force them to confess the crimes they didn't commit, particularly to murders. And by the way, was just released, by the way. So I wanted to put this question of torture in a much larger context. And I wanted to also talk about how we could understand it through what I call America's addiction to violence and what that meant in terms of a country that seems to have moved away from any sense of compassion or justice and equality and has become a kind of a hyper-militarized sort of dead zone of the imagination in which a culture of cruelty prevails.
One of the things that really struck me, too, is that, we're talking about this, and I think it's really important what you've done in relation to all this. The thing, though, that gets me is that, like you said, the U.S. has this long history of torture, both domestically and internationally. And, the Bush years, it was like watching, Eichmann and those above, all these people scurrying around doing this stuff and justifying it all. But this time, what was revealed here in this Senate report, it was much more developed and a much more monstrous level than I think anyone ever expected. Why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, what's so incredible about what the report reveals? And remember, a lot of this was revealed, in 2002 and 2005, right? I mean, some of this is not new. The rectal feeding, that was new. I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah.
But I think that what's so interesting about this is that the description of these utterly brutalizing, horrible acts, which, you know, the Democrats have taken up and tried to make public, are matched by a public, an American public, that for some reason, for whom it really doesn't register. They don't really understand that they live in a country in which the kind of tactics now being used illegally and justified by political monsters, I mean, there's just no other way to talk about them, aligns them with countries, parties such as Pol Pot, with the Adolf Eichmanns of the world, Cambodia, I'm sorry, with the Adolf Eichmanns of the world. And they just miss that kind of relationship. And, of course, there's also a certain sensationalism around these acts that ingratiate a certain entertainment value. Oh, my, let's hear more. And so, you know, you have these kind of decrepit sort of mainstream media people describing this stuff in detail and then ending their analysis or their descriptions with things like, well, does it really work? You know, the issue is not whether torture works. I mean, the issue is just to simply condemn it outright. There's no justification for this whatsoever under any circumstances. No democracy tortures. Mm-hmm. And I think what's shocking about the United States is that we have moved into a position where we not only have state-sanctioned torture, but we have people at the highest level of governments defending it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Darth Vader, Dick Cheney. I mean, my God, the ultimate vampire. You know, just appearing publicly and saying, I'd do it all over again. And when asked that question, when somebody asked him, they said, on Meet the Press, the question was raised, but there were innocent people who were tortured, people who were abducted, tortured. He said, well, the ends justify the means. My God. I mean, that's a prescription for totalitarianism.
You know,
that's not just about torture.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, though, too, because who was it? Nicole Wallace, who said, basically, you point out in your piece that she was being interviewed and she starts screaming, I don't care what we did. I don't care what we did. And she was one of Bush's top people, right? She was his communications chief. Yeah, yeah. And so you're looking at that and she says, I don't care what we did. And then you have, it's very heavy because you talk about, and I think this is important, you talk about this point you were raising about state violence and torture, et cetera, is justified as part of a state of exception in which a political culture of hyper-punitiveness is normalized. And you think about that, and you think about what was Obama's response to all this stuff, which was basically, you know, well, even when he first came in, you know, okay, we're not going to do torture. For whatever reason, he was saying, we're not doing this, we're not doing that. And that it still remains unclear what exactly has happened since Obama's in power. But he also said, we're not going to prosecute the people that are responsible for it.
I mean, look, you know, every day, people like you and I read the news, and, you know, you hear about lawyers like Lynn Stewart going to jail, a civil rights lawyer who basically, you know, is defending the voices of the oppressed. And then you see the president of the United States basically providing a pardon for people who have committed the most egregious acts of violence against other human beings, illegally committed these acts. And basically gives them amnesty. What that suggests to me is you have a country that not just simply legitimates lawlessness, it celebrates it. And so you see this notion of lawlessness, not just simply at the highest levels of government, you see it permeating everything. You see it in the paramilitarization of the police forces. You see it in white cops basically thinking that they can kill black youth with impunity. You see it in policies being passed that are so unethical, so cruel, that people basically who are just trying to survive have their social provisions being taken away more and more so that they basically find it difficult to even live anymore. And I think you put all this stuff together and you have to ask yourself, you know, what has the United States become? I mean, to what degree can we live the lie anymore that we live in a democracy? I mean, I think Russell Brand is right where he says at one level, we need to recognize that the reality of what the United States is compared to what it claims it is has to be made visible. The contradiction has to be made visible. He says, they try so hard that, you know, in the end, that suggests how weak they are. I don't think so. I mean, I think that you have a government that's actually indifferent to how people feel and that the only thing that they want to do is protect the interests of the financial elite, and they will do anything to do that. They don't have a conscience. You're talking about a financial elite that has come to power and is now in power as a result of the congressional elections. who represent one of the most extremist parties and governments we have ever seen in the United States. This does not bode well, believe me, for the next 4 years. And we want to hope that people recognize that this business about state-sanctioned torture is only one element as in part of an authoritarian society that basically will get worse before it gets better.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that in just a little bit, but I want to pursue some other angles here. But first, I want to let people know that, remind you that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Henry Giroux. And Henry is an author and professor. He currently holds a McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and a distinguished visiting professorship at Ryerson University. And actually, I should tell people, because I want people to read this book, Henry. It's very, very interesting, very heavy. It's called The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine, and it's put out by City Lights Press. So look for that book. Read it. Give you a lot to think about and chew on.
I love that book. It's one of my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you love it.
I have a lot of books. Some I don't like, but that's not what I like.
Yeah, I've been there. Anyway, here's the question, though. All the things that you're saying, and I think you speak to this in the book as well as the piece that you wrote, there's this point about this being normalized. I mean, this is a very heavy thing. And that, as you're saying, it's not just the danger of the threat that exists out there, but this has actually been normalized. And in a certain sense, like you pointed out, about where's the uproar that would be commensurate with the horror that's just been revealed, you know, and this normalization has a very bad impact. And the question is, how does it get there? And then what do you say about the impact of this normalization of state-sanctioned torture?
That's a terrific question for me in my work. And I think it goes right to the heart of how we want to define the nature of politics itself. I mean, I think that one of the things that the left has missed for a long time is they seem to think that domination is driven entirely by economics. And what they haven't understood is that well long before the 1970s, but particularly with the Powell memo, it becomes very clear that they believe that ideas matter. They believe in the educative nature of politics. In other words, that you have to basically not only put into place institutional and structural constraints, but you also have to produce particular kinds of subjects. You have to mobilize particular kinds of desires. You know, you have to turn citizens into consumers, for instance. You have to lead people to believe that politics is only about elections. You have to lead them to believe that the market basically is the template for all of social life, not just for economics per se. You have to lead them to believe that profit-making is the essence of democracy, or that self-interest is the only interest that matters, and that commerce is the only form of exchange that matters. And you pump this into the media, into all those cultural apparatuses that engage, not just in entertainment, but basically in education. And after a while, people can't imagine any other form of life. They can't imagine what resistance looks like. They can't imagine that capitalism is not democracy. They can't imagine that, for instance, democratic socialism is an alternative to what we have now, at least one viable alternative. And it seems to me that it's in that mode of normalization that the real power of capital resides. I mean, it's not just simply in the boots. It's not just simply in what, you know, in the surveillance state. It's really more like what Kafka and, it seems to me, Huxley talked about, that people will basically be laughing as they're oppressed. You know, they'll be enjoying themselves. They'll be shopping. When Bush said after 9/11, don't worry, just go shopping. You know, there's a real message here, right? You see it every day after a major entertainment event. People say, and now go to Disneyland. I mean, there's this disimagination machine that cleanses history of its complexity, of its struggles by women, by gays, by working class people, by unions. And in doing that, what it does is it presents a narrative that seems to be seamless, because it's a narrative that seems to be unchallenged. And I think that's the real price we pay when we have the cultural apparatuses controlled, plus the schools increasingly, controlled by the financial elite.
That's very heavy. I think this point about people's thinking, people's ideas, and they are a battleground for anyone who wants to actually change the world. And, you know, one of the things that happens, it reminds me of Marx's point about, you know, as long as people believe in the permanent necessity of capitalism, they're not going to be able to break free and actually change it, get out of it. You know, one of the things, though, too, that you point out, and this is kind of heavy because you also talk about, in addition to this sort of just the mindlessness of, you know, go out and shop, do this, all this other stuff, just ignore it, And it reminds you that, remember Brazil, one of my favorite films, where they used to be attention shoppers, you know, sort of citizens and all this stuff. And it was, life was a big mall, and you had this sweet voice that was sort of hypnotic over the, you know, everywhere you went. But there's an element here, too, of the creation of a culture of cruelty, which involves many, many different aspects. And this is something you've really dug into, and I'd like to talk about that a little, because that does have a lot to do with how people respond to horrors like this torture report.
I mean, I think that, you know, again, to me, a very important association, because it's not enough to simply say that people have been bamboozled into believing that torture works, right? You know, that's the pragmatic empirical argument. And that's, we know that's false. But I think that what happens when you live in a culture in which the ideologies, the policies, the social relations, and the values under a regime of neoliberalism take a very bizarre turn in that they completely deny the social contract, and they elevate self-interest to a level of being an organizing principle of society. And they organize a survival of the fittest ethos as a way to basically mobilize that society. What you then have is you have a society of atomized individuals who literally believe, as a result of this regime of neoliberalism, they believe that any form of dependency is a curse. Any form of compassion is basically a liability. Any form of dependency in which one exhibits some sort of compassion for the other is something to be mistrusted. Then you have policies implementing that. And when you have policies implementing that, they have to be legitimated. And how are they legitimated? They're legitimated in a discourse of cruelty, in which you say things like, homeless people are lazy. The unemployed just simply want to stay home and watch TV. You know, it goes on and on. Blacks are part of a culture of criminality. That's why we need the police. And you see it not just simply in policies and not just simply as an ideological legitimation. You see it all over the media. I mean, it's all over the media. I mean, it seems that we're at a point where violence represents one of the few representations, cinematic representations, where people can actually enjoy themselves anymore. I mean, there is almost nothing that isn't ensconced in violence. And it's not just the violence of the 50s and the 60s. It's like extreme violence. I mean, I think that what marks this period from the 1980s on, one of the things that marks it, is this indulgence in a kind of extreme violence that is just shocking, right? I mean, people's heads being cut off, people being gutted. Oh, my God. I mean, you can't turn on the television without somehow feeling that this is the only thing that actually ups the pleasure quotient anymore. So I think that you look at the culture, you look at the policies being implemented, you look at a regime of neoliberalism that basically hates any notion of the social, tried to destroy the welfare state, and what you get is a culture that all of a sudden revels in both violence, cruelty, and militarization, and a kind of hypermasculinity.
That basically flows right into my next question, which is, again, you know, you talk about throughout the book and throughout your piece, you talk about this escape from morality and the assertion of amorality. And I was thinking about that in relation to the idea, which I thought was really important. You know, the whole way that this torture report was approached from the powers that be in terms of, you know, well, it got us in a discussion. Was it right? Was it wrong? And you actually make a very important point that, wait a minute, shut up. There's nothing to discuss here.
The posing of the issue of torture in those terms, particularly not by the mainstream media and certainly not by the alternative media, you know, which doesn't pose that question at all, is a signal to me of the kind of moral coma that the United States has elapsed into, the kind of flight from ethics, the kind of flight from and retreat from the ethical imagination. Remember, we live in a system that says that economic interest can be divorced from social cost. And when you divorce actions from social cost, then you resort to arguments that basically have nothing to do with ethics whatsoever. So the question doesn't become, is torture a moral abomination? The question becomes, and here we go again, right? Lapsing into this empirical nonsense, that this instrumental rationality that has returned since the 1980s, does it work? That doesn't surprise me, actually. I think that almost every institution that we're now looking at in which education collapses into training, you know, the only question that matters is, does it work? I mean, how do we judge schools? We say, you know, do they create good consumers and good workers? Does it work? How do we measure that? This emphasis on empirical verification has in many ways just shut out the whole question of morality and social responsibility. Social responsibility at this point in American history is really a pathology. It's something that we don't want to talk about. It's something we don't want to face. People are atomized. They tend to live alone. They have no understanding of the other. Compassion is out. The cultural cruelty is in. And of course, there are people all over the place challenging this. But I think we need to recognize that it's that ethos with its lack of moral imagination that really has to be challenged and reclaimed.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with professor and author Henry Giroux. Henry's latest book is The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine, and we're talking about torture and the torture report that was released and what it shows about the society in this country. Henry, let's talk about this a little bit. You know, you had a very powerful part of your piece, the piece on torture that you wrote, and I think you also play this out in your book as well. You talk about that maybe it's time, you say, maybe it's time to treat the Senate torture report as one register of a series of crimes being committed by the system. And then you had a very beautiful, a very, you know, just horrifying listing of all the things when you go back through this whole register of, you know, this register of crimes and a series of crimes being committed by this system. But you also then get down to Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And Eric Garner saying, "I can't breathe." And you draw the tie there between Eric Garner saying, "I can't breathe," and perhaps a person has been waterboarded in some dark hole somewhere saying, "I can't breathe." And it tied that all well to get together very well and very movingly. I wanted you to talk about that a little.
When I read that, I thought of the Phoenix program. I thought of those Vietnamese tortured by the CIA. Mm-hmm. I thought of Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers and what happened to them. And you think of the endless people who are put in jail and incarcerated for and beaten and raped. And you can imagine them all. What ties all of this together is the same refrain. You know, I can't breathe. I can't breathe because the nature of state oppression is so overwhelming. You can't limit it to simply one injustice. Unless we can tie these injustices together historically and in contemporary terms, then we lose sight of the larger forces that produce them. And I think that's the key. That's where memory cannot fail us. And that's where politics has to become more capacious. You know, it has to understand the connections. I want to understand the connections between Eric Garner and Emmett Till, right? I mean, I want to understand what happened to Angela Davis and those who are uttering, "I can't breathe," in courts where they have no representation. I want to understand what happens to poor people who come up against social agencies and are punished for their deprivations, who can't breathe every day because they're just fighting to survive. "I can't breathe" is a metaphor for a kind of state violence whose tentacles are now reaching into almost every aspect of American life.
Now, you talk about, you also say, talk about the, you end your piece actually by talking about another kind of torture, similar, what you say, similar to the mind virus talked about in the Senate report, the impact of all this on society at large. And, you know, I kept thinking about that because you actually make this point throughout your book and throughout the piece that you wrote on the torture report, that actually what the impact of all this is much greater, much bigger, much heavier than what might appear immediately to be the impact, that there's actually something going on very deep in society and something changing, something that's actually a very, 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 I hesitate to say this because I don't want to seem sort of freakish about this, but there is a point about, there's a very evil thing being constructed that's both at the top, but also in terms of what we've been talking about the people, the impact on the people, the mind virus that happens and where that takes us, where it will take us.
I mean, I think, first of all, the mind virus metaphor is very interesting, right? I mean, because it suggests something that ties in with what Hannah Arendt talked about and what Franz Kafka talked about. And, you know, Arendt talked about the fact that thoughtlessness was the essence of fascism, of totalitarianism. And, of course, Kafka talked about the death of agency, because we're really talking about the death of agency, right? And what he called the helplessness of the living. And I think that the fact that a government can talk about creating a virus that actually depoliticizes people and takes away any sense of agency tells you something about how seriously they take the very notion of and possibility of agency itself and what it could do in opposition to what they believe in. But I think that as part of a kind of virus that we see emerging out of this sort of rabid market fundamentalism that now organizes almost everything in the United States, it's a kind of atomization, which I'm now beginning to write about, which I find enormously debilitating. I mean, we have so destroyed the notion of the social, so destroyed the notion of solidarity, so destroyed the notion of community and democratic values. You know, a society can't exist with just individuals. I mean, it just doesn't exist. You know, people are interconnected. They have to share things. I mean, they have to believe in the commons. They have to share air, water, you know, all those things that allow life to go on. But yet you have a prevailing ideology. Thank you, Hayek, Milton Friedman, and Ayn Rand, that says that selfishness is the ultimate measure of virtue. And I think it's this atomization which in many ways paralyzes people because they don't really know how to collectively organize. They can't imagine that all the problems that they're facing are not just problems that they have to bear responsibility for. We live in a society that has individualized the social, meaning it does two things. It says whatever problems you face, you are responsible for and nobody else. You just have to, you know, suck it up, right? It's about resilience and individual character. Well, we all know that that's nonsense. You and I are not responsible for the pollution of the environment. I'm sorry. You know, it doesn't work that way. The vast inequality and wealth and power in this country is not of my doing individually. It's not of your doing. The other side of this is that it becomes impossible to translate individual problems into social issue, larger social issues. And when you can't do that, that's about the death of democracy. I mean, we see people who are resisting this. I don't want to be overly pessimistic here. I mean, this is part of the language of critique and it's very necessary. But at the same time, you know, people are mobilizing. The contradictions are becoming so severe. When you have a whole generation of young people written out of the language of democracy, something's got to give. And I think that alternative institutions are being built, people are mobilizing, but what has to be done in light of, for instance, the Ferguson demonstrations all over the country, is to demonstrate is not enough. You have to build long-term organizations, and you have to build political formations that unite. We have to give up this reliance upon single-issue movements. And we have to come together, create a third party, another political movement, and we have to talk about going beyond reform. The system is not corrupt. The system is dead. It's systemically dead. It's beyond corrupt. This system is bought and sold by the rich. I mean, anybody who doesn't realize that is delusional. We know that. And so we have to begin to imagine what it would mean to live in a system that really serves human needs, that takes the social contract seriously. That's got to be fought for. That's hard work. And that work is not just about changing economic institutions. It's also about changing consciousness. And it's also about developing strategies and organizations that can do it over the long term.
Now, let me ask you this, Henry. This will be the last question. And it's something I wanted to ask you earlier, but it's just working its way out now, which is part of what ties all this together, including what you've just been talking about in terms of this mind virus and everything else and the impact on society overall, is there also is a tremendous amount, a really important element of dehumanization and the creation of disposable people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've argued in my work, as you probably know, that one of the people often say, what's different about the period in which we live as compared to, let's say, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. And I think that we need a language that needs to recognize the radicalness of the shift towards disposability, whether we're talking about inequality, poverty, imprisonment, foreclosed homes, with refugees, but the scope of those considered disposable and excess in the United States, those sort of abandoned to zones of terminal exclusion, whether they be poor minorities of class and color, or they be working class people, or they be the middle class, is expanding rapidly. Because for a very simple reason, you have a ruling elite now that has abandoned the social contract. It doesn't give a shit about anybody anymore because it doesn't make political concessions. The gap between power and politics is now so wide. Power is global. The ability to make decisions to get things done. Politics, which decides on what might be done, is now national and local. And that gap means that you have a financial elite that floats. It has no allegiance to states. It has no allegiance to workers. Workers don't like it that we're taking away their pensions. Too bad. We'll move to the south of China. And this makes for a political social formation that's ruthless in its willingness to implement its policies.
Mm-hmm. All right, Henry Giroux, we're going to have to stop it here, but I look forward to talking to you again, man.
Okay, thanks a lot, right. Michael.
Thank you, Henry. Take care. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with professor and author Henry Giroux, and Henry's latest book is The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine, and he's also on the board for Truth Out, and you can find his work there on a regular basis, so check that out, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Carl Dix to talk about where's things going? Where are things going and where are things at in the struggle against police brutality and to not just, you know, change this, but to not just fight it, but to actually end it all right? So stay tuned.
I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We calling out the violence of these racist police. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We call it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We're calling out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free.
I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle saying, I can't leave. Calling out the violence of these racist police.
All right, welcome back. That was the Peace Poets and their piece, I Can't Breathe, which has reached millions and millions and millions of people all across the country and around the world. And Samuel Jackson got up on YouTube and called on celebrities to come out and sing that wherever they were. Other people have been singing it in demonstrations everywhere they can. People have been raising their voices with this piece, right? And it's really, I think it's an incredibly important piece for people to be spreading, all right? And it really does help to create the kind of atmosphere we need today. And by the way, just in case people want to find Henry Giroux's work, somebody just pointed out to me, maybe I should spell his last name. It's G as in girl, I-R-O-U-X as in X people, whatever. Okay, so basically that's how you spell his name and you can find his work. Joining us now is Carl Dix. Carl is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's been one of the up front, constantly down with and fighting around police brutality and the whole way that people are treated this in under this system and the kind of organized violence that gets unleashed against people. And Carl's been out there in the forefront of fighting that and trying to figure out how to actually end it, where to take it and how to end it. And recently, he issued a call for New Year's resistance to police murder. No new year under this old system. We can't breathe. That was the rallying call for this holiday demonstrations. All right. And Carl's joining us today to talk about all this. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this, man. What's the gist? What's this no new year under this old system? We can't breathe. What's behind that slogan? And what was the reason for calling out these New Year's demonstrations?
Yeah, I mean, look, the basic reason for calling for the New Year's Eve demonstrations was you had 2014 winding to a close on a note of people having been in the streets for weeks all across the country saying no more to police murder, speaking outrage and bitterness at the grand jury decisions that exonerated the murderers of Michael Brown and of Eric Garner. And at the same time, you had the authorities working to ride out, hoping that the protest would ease, attacking them in various ways, arresting people, targeting leaders, all as a part of a plan and a move to suppress these protests. You had the seizing especially here in New York City, on the two police officers who got killed and trying to use that to change the terms of things around the marchers. You had like people like the head of the police, one of the police unions, talking about, well, the blood is on the hands of the people who've been protesting. So there were real attempts to try to suppress this thing. And this wave of protest was beautiful, powerful, and very necessary. Because without these protests, and they began in Ferguson right after the murder of Michael Brown, but without those outpourings, people would have never heard about Michael Brown's murder outside of that small town. All of this would have been pushed under the rug. So it was very necessary not only that it broke out, but that it not be suppressed, it not be co-opted, sucked back into the normal routine. So we felt like New Year's Eve was the time to issue this call. And when they're dropping that ball in Times Square and ringing in a new year, the message had to be out there that this new year, if the normality of police murder of black people is going to be part of the normal routine, and every indication was that it was going to be that, then the message of no new year under this old system needed to be put out there. They were really throwing this in our faces, because after people protested the grand jury exoneration of Michael Brown's murderer, Obama holds the meeting in the White House and he says, well, look, we'll get cameras on the police. We'll have videos of this thing. That'll help deal with this. Within a day, a grand jury says, it don't matter if you got a video of the police murdering somebody. We're going to exonerate that killer cop, too, in the Eric Garner case. Then there was Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee. There was a brother named Baker in Houston who had been killed by the police. Grand juries exonerated both of those murdering police. It was just being thrown in our faces, and we needed to stand up and say, uh-uh, no more. Our resistance to this, our refusal to put up with this, wasn't just something we did as 2014 wound down, but we're going to keep standing up. We're going to be keeping and continuing to say no more into this new year.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you give us a sort of, I know you can't go into every detail, but give people a sense of what did happen over the New Year's holiday.
Yeah, what happened is in cities across the country, Boston, Massachusetts, Los Angeles, Seattle, Atlanta, people took to the streets. People acted. They acted under that slogan. They brought other slogans. St. Louis, people marched to the main police station and delivered a people's eviction notice to the police department saying, you guys do not serve the people. In fact, you brutalize and murder the people. So as the people, we're evicting you. Here in New York City, people gathered and marched. We were denied permits by all of the authorities across the board in New York City. You can't gather, you can't march, you can't get anywhere near Times Square. We gathered, we rallied, we marched, and got to the crowd at Times Square and ended up with a die-in in front of Macy's at Herald Square. But all across the country, people took up this message. The reports are even just coming in now. Albuquerque, New Mexico, Cleveland, Chicago, just all kinds of places. And it was an important declaration that as we go into this new year, we're not stepping back. We're not declaring some kind of moratorium. We're not going to sit back and see what the system is going to do, because the system has already told us what it's going to do. It's going to continue to brutalize and murder people. And it's part of an overall slow genocide targeting black and Latino people, mass incarceration, police terror, racial profiling that puts whole generations of young people on a track into and out of prison. It's breaking the bodies and destroying the spirits of tens of millions of people in this country. It's illegitimate and unjust, and it's got to be stopped. And people need to stand up and be a part of stopping it.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the fight against police murder, police brutality, police murder, and where it's at, where it needs to go, what the goals are, how it's going to change, all of the stuff we're talking about today. Now, Carl, I want to move back for a minute to this question about when you talked about the incident that happened on, what was it, the 20th of December, the two cops being killed in New York. And the way that actually, you know, when you think about it, I was looking at that and I kept thinking, okay, there's been this polarization. It's been very favorable to a certain extent among the people, where people have actually come up and then been out in the streets and changed the sort of the terms of things in relation to police brutality and the terrible oppression that's been brought down and all too often has been sort of not gotten the kind of response that it needs to get from the people. But then you have this, you know, so you have that going on, and then you have this totally unrelated murder of these two cops, and suddenly everyone, I mean, you have de Blasio talking about he's going to do, you know, round up people and arrest them and do all this stuff, mass arrests, and you have all these things happening where suddenly the truth of the reality of the situation in the country overall in terms of the relationship between the police and the people, and especially black and brown people and black and brown youth, has been completely turned on its head. That's the attempt that they're trying to turn it all on its head and say, see, it's just like everybody's got some blame here. There's bad cops and there's bad people and there's, you know, but then they tie it into this whole movement needs to actually come together as one to fight for a civil society. And I think it's important that people get a sense of what's wrong with that.
Yeah, you know, that's an important point to bring up. One thing that needs to be recognized is that they were already working at that and just not having very much success. When Obama called a meeting at the White House, that was the point. Well, let's have a discussion about how we can bring the community and the police together. Well, for starters, how about if the police stop getting a green light to brutalize and murder black and Latino people? How about working on that? You know, but that wasn't being put forward as the issue, this different thing that we can bring things together. Then December 20th was seized upon as like, yeah, we can use this to beat back people who are standing up and protesting. Then you had the governor of New York, the mayor of New York, calling for a moratorium on the protests. You had the police unions attacking the mayor and attacking those protesting as, you know, being the problem and the ones who need to be targeted as part of the problem. You had calls to surveillance pictures of people at protests and calls for the public to help turn these people in. And it's like really striking. Here you have five cops murder Eric Garner on video and they get away with it. Then some people are charged with doing something at a protest and the public is supposed to help us find these so-called desperate criminals, and they actually were dealt with that way in the media, not as people who were suspected of something, but as actual criminals. That's what was being put out there, and that's because while there's fighting in the ranks of the powers that be over how to approach this, they're actually unified on one thing, and that is that these outpourings of powerful and beautiful resistance need to be suppressed. The normal routine of American society needs to go forward, including the brutality and the murder directed at black and Latino people. And that's what they're all united on, even as they fight over how to do it. And this points up a very crucial turning point situation that this movement of resistance is up against, because people are very determined that this needs to stop. And you can even see that in some of the New Year's Eve activity. You can see it in what happened here in New York with the refusal of the permits and everything, but people came out to march anyway. You can see it in what happened in St. Louis with marchers going to the police station and trying to enter the police station to deliver their eviction notice to the police in the face of police attacks there. And there's a question of what is it going to take to end this? And look, that's one thing that I've been addressing this question since back in the 90s when I was a co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality back then. And that is, we need massive powerful resistance, and that's something that's coming forward right now. But what is, and that's needed to beat back these attacks and to transform the terms around this in society, with people seeing the reality of this outrage of police murder. But it's going to take an actual revolution. That's what's needed to end this once and for all. And that's what's needed to end not only this horror of the slow genocide of mass incarceration and police terror, but all the horrors that this capitalist imperialist system brings down on people, from the war on women that's raging through society, the devastation of the environment, the drone missile strikes, the torture, all of it. That's the way to end the horrors coming down on people all around the world. And, you know, the Revolutionary Communist Party that I'm a representative of, we're building a movement for revolution, and people need to get with that movement. They need to check it out. They can go to the website revcom.us and see what we have to say, but also what we have to do, what we're involved in, what we're taking up, including being involved in and helping to give leadership to this movement of resistance on this front.
Let me ask you this, Carl. Let me ask you this question real quick, because you're getting into what I wanted to talk about now, actually, so it's good. But I wanted to ask you this, because on the one hand, you say we need this resistance, and then you say, but we have to have this in order to really stop it. We need this revolution. And I don't think it's always understood by people. What's the actual relationship between the resistance that is necessary and the actual revolution?
Look, from one end, if people don't stand up and resist, they're going to beat us down so far that we'll never be able to do anything about it. People can get to the point where, one, broadly in society, the justifications for this violence, state violence targeting Black and Latino people, that, well, there's criminals and a whole generation of criminals and thugs, and this is the only way we could keep them down. But also, the people who are being targeted can begin to accept these justifications that, well, what they do really brings this down on them, which they are told time and time again from every angle. So we have to beat that back. And the way to beat that back is to go to people and take to them the reality of why this is happening, and that they can and must stand up and do something about it. And that's very important. And then at the same time, as people stand up, as they begin to resist, they can raise their sights. They can begin to get a sense of where all this is coming from, why it's happening. They can also begin to get a sense that when they stand up, there are others who will stand up with them and help to take this on, people who they wouldn't necessarily have known were their potential allies until they stood up. And we're seeing that right now in a lot of these protests, because Black people are standing up and saying no more to this stuff. But at the same time, you've got people in these protests who are acknowledging and even saying, I know this is something that isn't targeting me, but I can't stand aside and let it come down on anybody else. And what I'm talking about here is a strategic approach that we in the Revolutionary Communist Party take to the process of preparing and getting ready for revolution. And it's something that we call fight the power and transform the people for revolution. Building this resistance to these very real attacks that do need to be beaten back, that the terms of which do need to be changed, but at the same time, through the course of that and in relation to that, bringing to people the understanding of why this happens and that revolution is needed to get rid of it, and also developing the understanding, the strength, the unity, and the organization to be ready and in position to carry out that revolution when the time comes, when the time is right for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, Carl. And I think this is something that there's a lot of different thinking about this. There's a lot of different ideas out there. We just talked with Henry Giroux, and he was putting out his view of what it means to actually change this, what's needed. And he was talking about you have to get beyond reform. You have to do this, you have to do that. But you actually, when you talk about it, you talk about an actual revolution. And I don't know that people understand what an actual revolution is. You know, it's not just sort of changing the party in power. It's not getting a third party, things like that. But there's an actual revolution that needs to be carried out. And you're talking about that in relation to all this. I think it's important what you're saying. But how about we talk about, as the last question, we talk about what actually is this And maybe I'll lie because I'll have one more question for you. But what actually is this actual revolution?
Yeah, an actual revolution is an act of millions and millions of people who have reached a point where they refuse to live in this way anymore. It's not something you can do anytime you wanna. It's something you can only do when the conditions are right for it in society, when the ruling class, those who own and control and run things, are deep in crisis, dividing up and fighting amongst each other. And you need to have leadership that has been preparing for this moment and preparing the people for this moment and can see the developing situation and that the time is right and lead people in forging the kind of broad unity that is possible to actually take the power from the hands of that ruling class. And that would mean leading people in taking on and defeating the attempts at violent suppression that the rulers will inevitably bring down. I mean, they're already bringing that down on a very significant scale, and in the face of a revolutionary people numbering in the millions, those attempts would be even more widespread. But those would need to be taken on and defeated. The political apparatus would need to be dismantled, and a new society with new economic relations, new political relations, and a whole different social ethos, a whole different way that people relate to each other, not a handful of people on top exploiting and oppressing the great majority of society and of humanity worldwide, but people working together in common for the common good, producing what society and humanity needs and distributing it to those who need it. That's what an actual revolution would comprise, and that's something that we get into at that website that I talked about, revcom.us, and I encourage people to go there and to look at that, both look at the strategy for bringing that kind of revolution about, which is on that website, and descriptions of the kind of world that this revolution would be aimed at bringing into being, including a constitution for the way that kind of society would function in the immediate aftermath of a successful revolution in a country like the United States.
And that has everything to do with being able to imagine. Being able to imagine and to understand what could happen has everything to do with that actually being able to happen. Carl, 1 minute, maybe a minute and a half. What's out there for the future plans right now, the immediate future, not the long-term future, but what's out there? What's up now?
Well, what's up now is that the outpourings need to continue, and in fact, there are plans all over the country for these kinds of things to happen. People are highlighting, again, the reality of the widespread nature of police murder in this society. Like, there's going to be a 24-hour effort at Grand Central Terminal in New York City reading the names of those killed by the police. And it could take you more than 24 hours to do that. Things like that are being done all across the country. We also have to work on bringing together and bringing out more diverse groupings of people, more prominent people, some of the athletes and others, like the Samuel Jackson piece about doing the song, the athletes, you know, wearing the I Can't Breathe t-shirts. More of that needs to go on. And it really does have to be that this new year is going to be one where people are going to refuse to accept those old horrors and actually bring together more of the horrors that are out there. You know, like January 22nd, there's going to be a big protest of the war on women around the attempts to outlaw abortion. I'm going to be going down to Washington, D.C. for January 22nd, and I'm issuing a challenge to people fighting around police murder of black people that we got to go from fighting on one front to being fighters against all oppression.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, take care. Talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the fight against police brutality, where it's at, where it's going, and what it's going to take to stop it, to end it once and for all. All right, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show, but before we go, there's something that I really think is very appropriate to read, especially off of both of these segments in the show today, both what Henry Giroux was talking about in relation to torture and disposable people and the whole horror that this system is bringing down on the world. And then with Carl Dix talking about the need to stop police terror and murder now. The need for this stuff to stop now. Not tomorrow, not a year from now, but now. And the need for people to be out there fighting against that. And in the long run, what Carl was talking about with this, the need for revolutionary change in order to not just end police terror and brutality, but to bring in a whole new world that's worthy of human beings. All right, so this is called Three Strikes. And it's a statement by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which you can find in his book, Basics. So, Three Strikes. The book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, has shined a bright and much-needed light on the reality of profound injustice at the very core of this country. And this brings me back to a very basic point. This system, in this country, in the whole history of its treatment of black people, what has it been? First, slavery. Then, Jim Crow, segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror. And now, the new Jim Crow, police brutality and murder, wholesale criminalization and mass incarceration, and legalized discrimination yet again. That's it for this system. Three strikes and you're out. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And once again, it's from his book, Basics. And you can find Basics as well as other works by Avakian and Revolution Newspaper on the site revcom.us. And I really encourage everyone to go there, including go there and look up, as Carl was mentioning earlier, go there and look up the Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America, a draft proposal. Look that up and look at how the world could be different. How life could be different, how society could be different, including around this question of the role of the police in society. I want to thank all of my guests today, Henry Giroux and Carl Dix. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And you can write to me if you want at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out with a very special song. It's by Santana, and it's a song called One of These Days.
Yeah!